Hi, this is Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. To start off this episode, I need you to do something for me. Close your eyes and imagine spring. That's pretty good, but this isn't just any spring we're talking about. This is spring in North America about 13,000 years ago. It's the tail end of the last ice age, and that means an entire continent is thawing out. Now, 13,000 years ago is prehistoric to us, but in terms of biological evolution, it was just yesterday. Many of the plants and animals we see in North America today were around then too, but there were some differences, and they were big.
There would have been elephants that appeared much like those in Africa. There were types of lions that looked just exactly like the ones in Africa today. There were tigers here, giant wolves, just a whole array of very exotic animals that would have made it look more like the African savanna than here.
That's Alan West. He's a retired geophysicist who's become fascinated by this moment in time. The creatures he's talking about are the megafauna of North America. The mammoth, the mastodon, and dozens of other giant-sized species that were dominating the continent throughout the Pleistocene. And then suddenly, they were gone. Just under 13,000 years ago, as the Big Thaw was in full swing, the climate suddenly made a U-turn, and it returned to Ice Age conditions. And it's just at that moment that the megafauna disappeared from the fossil record. Over the years, scientists have put forward a lot of different ideas to account for this sudden disappearance. And not surprisingly, climate change is a prime suspect.
And the typical explanation is that with a radical change like that, some animals just cannot adapt. That's one of the classic explanations of what happened to the mammoths and the mastodons, the giant elephants, that they just couldn't adapt to the sudden changes, and so they died out.
But there could be a problem with this story. Before they abruptly disappeared, many of those groups of animals had been around for millions of years, and they'd survived other episodes of climate change. That suggests there may have been another factor, and maybe that factor was us. 13,000 years ago corresponds to the arrival in North America of a band of Stone Age big game hunters known as the Clovis people.
Some people would have called them cave people, but they didn't live in caves. They would have been nomadic people, that hunters and gatherers that moved frequently across the landscape. Typically would have been in small bands, maybe no more than a dozen people, a family unit. And there would have been not too many of them here. There might have been less than 10,000 or so, or 20,000 across the entire continent. So that's the second hypothesis, is that because humans arrived on the scene, because they were deadly hunters, and because the animals had never seen this predator before, that they were able to drive these animals into extinction.
So climate change, or overhunting, or some combination of both, is the standard explanation for why the megafauna died out. But Alan West, along with a very diverse group of colleagues, says a third factor could be at play, a cosmic factor.
We don't know exactly what it was yet, but all evidence points towards some kind of impact event, either an airburst above the ground or an impact into the huge ice sheet that covered most of Canada at that time. So an impact into the ice sheet would have caused just as much trouble as one into the land, but of course would have left less evidence.
Just like an impact is thought to have wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, West and his collaborators think that something similar happened to the mammoths. They think an impact is behind all the big changes that happened at that time, and their evidence is based on microscopic markers that have been dug up all around North America and Europe in sediments that date back to the time when the big animals disappeared.
We find magnetic spherules, which look a little like round bullets, except they're very tiny. We find carbon spherules, which are what are left over when trees burn. So we have a line of about 14 or 15 markers that's identical to the markers found in the dinosaur extinction event. In fact, only two levels in all of geologic history, that is, people have looked at rocks in all different ages, and there are only two times in past history where all of these markers occur together, and one of them was for the dinosaur extinction, or KT event, and the other one is this one 13,000 years ago. So because of that similarity of finding the same markers in these two events, then the best explanation so far is that some kind of cosmic impact occurred 13,000 years ago, too. Smaller than the one that killed the dinosaurs, but nevertheless, an impact.
But if that's true, this more recent impact wasn't just smaller, it had to be different. When scientists analyzed the sediment that dates back to the extinctions of the dinosaurs, for example, the so-called KT layer, they find high levels of iridium, an element that's much more common in asteroids than in Earth's crust. That's not true of the sediment that corresponds to the mammoths going extinct. There's hardly any iridium there at all. But West has an answer for that.
The one that hit in the dinosaur times was almost certainly a very large rock of some kind. It was typically much higher in metal and also higher in iridium, which is a metal as well. And, of course, it was much bigger also, so a bigger object of different kind is going to leave a lot more iridium. The amount of iridium that we see is really minuscule compared to what happened at the KT, and it's much, much more difficult to detect because of that. So the two were different impactors. One was a rock, and we think the one 13,000 years ago almost certainly was a comet. And the reason is that we don't find all of these classic indicators of a giant rock hitting the Earth.
The idea is that a comet wouldn't leave the same iridium fingerprint that an asteroid would, but skeptics of the impact theory remain unconvinced. They say that the climate change and the extinctions that happened 13,000 years ago can be explained in more conventional ways. And according to Mark Boslow, who specializes in impacts at Sandia National Labs, it's pretty hard to hide an impact that devastating, especially if it happened so recently.
An event that was 13,000 years ago, I mean, if you had a big crater-forming event, yeah. You know, there would still be steaming holes in the ground. You know, it would be obvious. It just wouldn't be a controversy if there was that big of an impact that recently.
Once again, Alan West has a response for critics like Boslow.
Of course, one of the major criticisms is that there is no crater. But I would just say that there are known impact events that don't produce craters, and the Tunguska event in 1908 in Siberia is one. It's widely accepted by everyone that this was a cosmic airburst, that an object came in and blew up in the atmosphere. Well, the effects of that blast were not trivial. It knocked over and burned 80 million trees over very large areas. And if it had blown up over modern-day Moscow or London, it would have absolutely flattened the city. So, I mean, this was a catastrophic event, and it was created by a relatively small rock, one that might have been only 10, 20, 30 meters across, which is maybe house size. I mean, that's fairly large, but it was just tiny compared to the KT impact. So here is a widely accepted cosmic event, whether you technically call it an impact because it hit the atmosphere, not the Earth, that's a matter of semantics. The fact of the matter is Earth got hit by a cosmic object that produced devastating consequences.
But with no crater to act as the smoking gun, Alan West and his partners have instead focused on a different line of evidence. Tiny little mineral grains called nanodiamonds. And they really are diamonds.
Whereas I'm sure everyone's aware of the diamonds that you get in a ring, well, that's just one type of diamond. There are really quite a few types, and in this impact deposit, we found five different varieties of diamonds. Now, they're all diamonds, and they vary with just the way their lattice is made, the way the carbon atoms are arranged. And, of course, the one that we find that's the same as in jewelry is called a cubic diamond. We do find those, but the more interesting kind is called a hexagonal diamond. And the only difference is the way the carbon atoms are arranged, they're arranged in a hexagonal pattern. Well, that particular type of diamond is only found in two places on this planet.
Those two places are inside meteorites or in craters. The hex diamonds seem to form whenever carbon is subject to high temperatures and high pressures like those in an impact. That should make them very rare on Earth, but when you check sediments that were deposited 13,000 years ago, around the time the mammoths disappeared, things get interesting.
Well, in this layer, 13,000-year-old layer, we do find these hexagonal diamonds, and we found them from offshore California up into Alberta and Michigan and the Carolina coast. And just recently, we found them in the 13,000-year-old layer in Germany and the Netherlands, Spain, England, and as far east as Syria. And we find them only in this impact layer, the 13,000-year-old layer, and we don't find them above it or below it. So these unusual kind of diamonds, which are typically considered to be extraterrestrially connected, they don't necessarily come from space, but they're produced when a space object hits us. So we find these. We've actually been halfway around the planet now nearly, and we've never found a spot that's 13,000 years old that does not contain these diamonds.
So with the impact hypothesis apparently riding on these little diamonds, I wanted to find out more. So I spoke with Wendy Wallback. She's a chemist at DePaul University in Chicago, and she's the one who isolated the diamonds from the samples that Alan West and others have gathered in the field. Wendy Wallback, welcome to the Universe in Mind.
Hello.
So the suggestion that a comet impact of some kind had a role to play in the extinction of the mammoths and other animals 13,000 years ago, it all seems to hinge on these very small diamonds. So first of all, just to get some perspective, how small are they?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, they're very tiny, and I think the best analogy I've heard is that if bacteria had engagement rings, these would be the size of the diamonds on those rings.
Okay, so that's a really nice example. So you're telling me these are smaller than bacteria?
Yes.
So with such small samples, how can you actually isolate them, you know, to study, let alone get useful information from them?
Well, the first thing you have to do is pull them out of the rock. And so my part of the project is that I take the original rock samples, and then I dissolve them with a series of acids and other organic chemicals. And each treatment is designed to remove a different kind of mineral or a different type of organic component. And ideally, when I'm done with my long process, the rock has disappeared, and organic carbon and other forms of carbon that are not diamonds have disappeared, and I'm left with just the nanodiamonds.
And I guess because diamonds are so hard, you know, they're more resistant to the kind of solvents that you're using to break this material down.
Yes, they are elemental carbon, and there are other forms of elemental carbon, but these are very hard. But because they're so small, they react closer to other forms of elemental carbon than you might think from, for example, a diamond that you would see in a diamond ring. So we do have to be very careful that we don't treat the samples too harshly with the chemicals, otherwise we would dissolve these diamonds as well. And that's one of the things we've learned as the protocols have been developed.
Now, where do the samples come from, and how many have you looked at approximately?
Well, the samples come from a number of different sites across North America. I'm currently working on some sites from Europe. And from West Coast to East Coast to Canada. So there are a number of different sites, and they have been supplied to me by Alan West.
So they're coming from all over the place, but yet, as you say, they're small enough to be the engagement rings for bacteria. So how many do you end up isolating? I mean, how do you even know they're in there because they're so small?
Well, they are small, but they're very abundant. For example, we found them in some samples at the same levels as they have been found at the KT boundary when the dinosaurs became extinct. And those quantities are greater than a billion per cubic centimeter of these tiny nanodiamonds.
So that's interesting. You are finding some comparison between this, you know, the layer that coincides with the extinction of the mammoths 13,000 years ago. You're finding a comparison or a similarity with what happened to the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
Yes, there are a number of markers in the rock layer that dates to the time of the end Pleistocene that are very similar to markers we find at the KT boundary. And nanodiamonds are just one of them. There are many other similarities between the two extinction horizons. But the diamonds are one of them, and I think they've been studied much more at the end Pleistocene than they've been studied at the KT boundary. But where KT boundary samples have been looked at, they have been found.
Now, I want to ask you more about the KT, but I just have to back up for a second and sort of ask the scientific question about controls and so on. I mean, are you also looking at samples that are sort of above and below this layer that coincides with the extinction of the mammoths? Is the occurrence of those nanodiamonds very sort of abrupt and strong, as you might expect from, you know, a sudden event?
Oh, that's a great question. Absolutely, because we want to make sure that we have sort of a control or a background or a baseline comparison. And we have not found these in the samples above and below. It's a very sharp demarcation, and they appear very suddenly in the sedimentary rock record. And so I have worked on many, many samples, only some of them corresponding to the extinction horizon itself. A lot of them, in fact, most of them are from above and below that boundary layer.
Okay, so there is, as you say, this layer of diamonds that's very distinct. So clearly something happened that produced these diamonds. Does it require an extraterrestrial impact or an extraterrestrial explanation, do you think?
Well, I think these, so far to our knowledge, this type of diamond that's mentioned in the paper, these hex diamonds, have only been found associated with impacts. And so we think that you need an impact to produce these diamonds, and that's one of the fundamental reasons why we are suggesting that there was a cometary explosion or impact of some sort that triggered the extinctions at the end Pleistocene. There are other types of nanodiamonds that can form in other ways. For as far as we know, though, this is the only way hex diamonds can be formed, and therefore that's very suggestive of an impact.
So basically, either there was an impact or there's something about how these diamonds form that we don't know yet.
Well, that's very possible. I know there are people that are trying to find other mechanisms that could make hex diamonds. And if they can find another mechanism, that certainly would be food for thought. And it would be new evidence to help us better understand what was happening at the end Pleistocene. I mean, as I said before, the diamonds are only one marker that suggests an impact. There are others, but I think the diamonds are the most persuasive.
So as you say, you've worked a lot on the KT samples as well, and so you've had a lot of time to kind of live with that idea of extinction by impact. Do you find yourself persuaded by this case, this more recent case?
I am, because right now I don't have any evidence to suggest that the hex diamonds were formed any other way. And I think, for me, that's the final nail in the coffin of anti-impact argument. However, as I said before, if new evidence arises, I certainly will reconsider my position.
Why do you think there's so much interest in the mammoths and what happened at this time?
I'm not sure. I think it's similar to the interest in the extinction of the dinosaurs. People imagine these large beasts suddenly becoming extinct, and perhaps on some level they wonder if an extinction could happen to them. We are, after all, large creatures, and if environmental changes can change, if environmental changes can take place that can lead to extinction of large animals, whether they be dinosaurs or mammoths or giant sloths, et cetera, then it gives us pause in terms of our own future. Because after all, we could very easily be hit by a meteorite or comet sometime in the future.
Well, Wendy Walbeck, thank you so much for giving us a glimpse into the science behind this interesting story. And of course, we're looking forward to hearing more.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
This is not a story with a tidy ending. Alan West and his colleagues are continuing to gather evidence, and so far they say that evidence suggests there really was an impact around the time that the mammoths and other big animals of North America disappeared. Whether that impact triggered the climate change and the extinctions is a more complicated question. And so is the question of whether humans played a role in the extinctions, or whether they simply suffered the effects of an impact alongside their big game prey. What's clear is that the Clovis culture also vanished with the mammoth, and was ultimately replaced by humans that lived differently. Over 10,000 years later, those humans gave rise to the Native Americans that were present when Europeans first reached the New World. Since we don't know for sure what happened, I'm going to leave you with three perspectives. First, from Alan West.
As a scientist, you have to say not, how can I prove that such and such occurred, that's fitting the event to the evidence. Instead, we started with, here's the evidence, what kind of things could have produced it? But I think the best explanation, that, and we arrived at it relatively early, they're just process of elimination, leads you to the point where they're just not any, there isn't any other thing that explains what we see. So if this wasn't an impact, then it's something new that no one has seen before.
Now, there are still lots of objections to the impact hypothesis, including the sheer improbability that such a large impact, perhaps a once-in-10-million-year event, would have happened so recently and yet left such sparse evidence. And while the nanodiamonds must be telling us something, they may simply be telling us that when the climate changed 13,000 years ago, the forests dried out and sparked a continent-wide wildfire. Perhaps there's a way that such a conflagration could have produced a few hex nanodiamonds, like Alan West is seeing. Here's Mark Boslow.
You know, it's really becomes a matter of uncertainty. Am I more likely to, you know, accept that it has to be an impact, or am I more inclined to accept that we don't fully understand all the processes that can form these diamond allotropes? You know, I prefer the latter, that we don't have full understanding of how these things can form.
These days, Mark Boslow is working in the lab studying how hex nanodiamonds form. He's putting the impact theory to the test. For her part, Wendy Walbeck thinks that's great.
When you do something and people notice it, and they actually base their experiments based on your results, I mean, there are a lot of people who do work and they publish it and nobody cares and it just languishes and nobody builds on it. But this is building on research, and this is the way science works, and that's a neat thing.
So there you have it, the current state of a controversial line of research. If you'd like to find out more, I've written a feature about it in the September 2009 edition of Sky and Telescope magazine. And stay tuned. Whatever the final answer is, I'm betting we're going to be hearing a lot more about the impact hypothesis over the next few years. Maybe then we'll finally understand what happened to the mammoth. That's it for this edition of The Universe in Mind. If you have any thoughts or questions about our show, please send your emails to comments@theuniverseinmind.com, and The Universe in Mind is all one word. The Universe in Mind is sponsored by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. You can find us online at www.di.utoronto.ca/journalist, or simply by subscribing to The Universe in Mind on iTunes. Kathy Parrott is our online producer. I'm Ivan Semenek. Please join us again. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind.